Hello and welcome to the CGF Sustainability Podcast Series. My name is Louise Chester and I work in the communications team at the Consumer Goods Forum. In this series, we take a deep dive into all things sustainability, from forced labour to plastics, deforestation, food waste and refrigeration. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Brent Wilton, Director of Global Workplace Rights at the Coca-Cola Company. Brent has played a vital role in our work on forced labour over the past few years and is now the newly appointed manufacturer co-chair of the Human Rights Coalition working to end forced labour. I'm really looking forward to getting his insights on the topic as it's one that he is hugely knowledgeable on. Hello, Brent. Thank you very much for joining me today on the CGF podcast. How are you doing?
Very well, Louise. Thanks very much for inviting me. We're living in interesting times, but we're coping, I think.
Yes, indeed, indeed. We have to keep the morale high. So I wanted to talk to you today a little bit about forced labour, because you've been leading our work at the CGF on this topic for several years now, and indeed leading the industry forwards. So could you start by telling our listeners a little bit about the Coca-Cola Company's work and projects on the topic?
Yes, certainly. I mean, our work on forced labour goes back many years. We started doing social auditing of our supply chain in 2003. And even then, forced labour or the prevention of it was included in the work that we were doing with our suppliers and our system bottlers. That work has deepened over time as a result of changes in legislation, but also in terms of an increasing focus amongst various stakeholders around the fact that this ongoing scourge of modern slavery, as it's commonly called today, was continuing to manifest itself in ways and in places that we previously hadn't thought about. Then in 2012, the US government introduced new rules with regards to government procurement. And the US government's the largest buyer in the world. And of course, the Coca-Cola Company is a supplier to the US government. So that gave us an opportunity to basically let our industry know what we needed to do about forced labor. There was a 12-month grace period. So we changed our audit program to put in place the elements around no employee pays, no retention of documents, clarity of terms and conditions of employment to avoid substitution fairly early on. And we told our industry then that if you don't comply with those things in 12 months, then you're going to have findings against you and your score could jeopardize your ability to supply to our company. That brought about a fundamental change in our business. And I think since then, we have continued to build on that engagement with our members. We do a lot of training of suppliers and even our bottling community around what we expect with regards to forced labor and the elements that create it. And of course, now we've got the CGF's priority principles, which also deeply align with that. So we continue that exploration. We also did some deep dives into our sugar industry around the world to look at what was going on the ground with regards to child labor, forced labor, and land rights. And so again, forced labor was a real focus of the work that we did when we did those deep dives to see exactly what was happening in the reality on the ground. And those reports are now published on our website. So for us, it's always been a very fundamental thing. And for me personally, I'd have to say the fact that we are living in the 21st century with this reality still being present in our supply chains and our businesses is something we really need to focus on.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you mentioned the CGF's priority industry principles, and I know it's been around 2 years, maybe a little bit more now, since we launched our social resolution on forced labour and the PIPs that came along just afterwards. So In your honest opinion, what have we really achieved since then? And have the resolution and the PIPs really helped to drive progress or not so much? I'd like to know what you think.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair question. I mean, the challenge you have with an issue like forced labor and modern slavery, it has been around in our societies in different forms and in different ways for thousands of years. So this is not going to be something that is going to happen overnight. But to me, the priority principles that we have been able to promulgate and to communicate have led to adoption of them in a variety of different fora now. And so for me, it's very encouraging when I engage across a number of platforms with regards to forced labor, the understanding of the PIPs is very much present in those discussions. I think everybody understands that they are the key elements, not the only elements, but key elements in the fight against forced labour. So whilst people may say that, well, you know, progress is slow, progress is going to be slow. We have to accept that. This is endemic in some of our communities. And you've got to be able to make people understand the need to change and the need to do that through not just multinationals shouting down their supply chain, but also engaging the suppliers in the local communities where these practices seem to be more acceptable than perhaps they are in the West, and start to change people's attitudes to the way in which people are treated and the way they work. So yeah, I think it's made a big difference. And I think one of the things I like about the principles are they are simple. This is not hard to explain. The fact that people should not have to pay for a job is not rocket science. And so I think keeping it simple has meant that we're able to address large, medium and small companies in this dialogue.
Yes, and I was just thinking we should probably mention for any listeners who aren't familiar with the PIPs what those three principles actually are. So have them in front of me. We have every worker should have freedom of movement. No worker should pay for a job and no worker should be indebted or coerced to work. Very simple, as you said, but very important.
Yeah, so we have to put it in that local context for people to understand what we mean.
Yeah, indeed. So sticking to the CGF's work stream, just for my next question, we're gearing up to go public and launch our coalition of action on human rights and forced labour. We've just had this validated by our governance task force. I'm very happy about that. So you've been at the forefront of developing this. What makes it different to what we had before?
I think the coalition charter has brought greater focus to what it is that we are trying to do. It means that we are really sort of taking a laser approach to addressing forced labour as a challenge within our own business, which I think is equally important as trying to deal with it through the supply chain. The other thing the charter does is to focus people's minds. This is really about building coalitions of the willing. And I think it means that people who are engaging with us, and I hope more and more companies within the CGF community look to this coalition as being a useful spending of their time, recognize that this coalition is actually now having set itself some goals and targets as to what it wants to achieve in the short, medium, and longer term. But as I said, this is going to be learning by doing. I see this very much as a 1.0 attempt to make sure that we are really boring into this issue in a sustainable way that's going to last over time. But we also need to be flexible enough to recognize we will learn as we do this, and we will make changes to the charter content, I'm sure, over time to ensure it reflects the changes that we're making as we move along.
Okay, so I wanted to just switch gears and talk about a topic that I think is basically completely at the heart of what we do at the CGF, and that is collective action. It's a topic we talk about a lot because we firmly believe, especially in the human rights work stream, that convening the different players from industry actors, stakeholder organizations to governments is the way to break down the silos that exist in this field. So in your opinion, what's the value of coming together to move the needle?
It's invaluable, simple as that. I have been a big proponent of this collaboration across members, across other initiatives, in order to make sure that when we are engaging our businesses around the world as suppliers or whatever, we're sending a consistent message. Because it's only through consistency that we are going to move the needle, rather than each and every one of 1,000 different initiatives trying to do their own thing in their own way, competing for resources, competing for attention, etc. Coming together and consolidating our strengths means we can focus on where we have strategic value to add, so that we're not all trying to do everything for everybody, but playing to the strengths of the coalition partners, playing to the strengths of the stakeholder groups that we're emerging with, playing to the strengths of the other initiatives that we are partnering with. As companies, we belong to a lot of these different initiatives that have emerged over time, slightly different industry focus, whatever. But at the end of the day, to move the needle, there has got to be this collaboration. And that's where I think the CGF platform being led by CEOs enables us to really be able to access the powers within our own businesses to assist us in driving that collaboration. It's so essential, I can't stress it enough. If you turn up at a meeting with suppliers where there is more than one brand in the room, the message you send to those suppliers is massive compared to just one brand standing there having that conversation. We need to show to the global community that this is not just an ask of one business, but this is an ask of business generally, and that we want to engage and help those companies that are our suppliers or whatever to understand what we need in a consistent way so they know what to do. Mixed messages, as we're seeing at the moment with this pandemic, are not helping the people's understanding.
Yeah, I think that's very powerful what you just said about consistency and consolidating strengths of the different players. That you've definitely hit the nail on the head there. And I wanted to just pull upon what you mentioned about bringing CEOs, getting CEOs to step up and speak about this too, because it's very important that we get our members at the CGF and beyond to speak up publicly on this topic. And we know that it's often a challenge for members to get that sort of internal buy-in to persuade their CEOs to take the stage and speak. How would you advise peers in the industry to persuade perhaps reluctant colleagues to speak up?
Yeah, it's a difficult one because, of course, people look at this issue in different ways from where they sit. I've always found that within the Coca-Cola company, because of our early engagement around this issue and our commitment to human rights as a fundamental principle by which we operate, this has not been hard to do. But I understand that some instances where you start making statements against interest, as they're called, where you put your company at perhaps legal risk by admission, makes it difficult. And of course, we have new legislation in the US around border importation of products with forced labor, which also makes people nervous about admitting that they have it. But again, I think if you cloak it within a broader discussion with your C-suite, around what are the values and principles that guide you as a company, you can start to build that conversation. I mean, we didn't leap to a human rights policy immediately. We went through a progression over the years as we built that understanding internally. So it's a matter of just a bit like water on rock. You just got to keep going back.
So we're hearing more and more these days about possible regulatory frameworks around corporate human rights due diligence, big topic there. So do you personally have high hopes that these governmental efforts can help in addressing the risks around forced labour?
I think we're also one of the companies that hopes that regulation properly formatted, properly consulted with, can be useful. But again, the challenge you have is every government doing its own thing, which can create a myriad array of expectations and requirements that can be difficult for a global company to deal with.
Yeah.
The challenge around this is that there is still not a great understanding, I believe, in government levels about what actually a supply chain looks like. We had a recent discussion in the ILO where it was very clear that there was no common understanding of what a supply chain was for the purposes of trying to put in place approaches to address some of the challenges that may be created by them. Yes, I think there is always going to be the case that government will act, and it's acting because there is a lack of a framework. But there needs to be flexibility in the approach to enable companies to be able to work in the nature of their own supply chain, not a supply chain that is envisaged by a government which has no understanding of the reality. So they need to be cautious, they need to be consulting widely on it, and they need to make sure that this is applicable to everybody. This idea of multinationals or large companies being the particular problem and small national companies not being a problem is a little bit of a misnomer today. I mean, many small companies are part of global supply chains. Many small companies are global traders. Mm-hmm. And so you can't just say this is just a challenge just for the multinationals. The reality is, and recent research has shown, that most of the challenges around forced labor and child labor exist within national economies, not within global supply chains. The ILO's done some interesting work on this recently. So it's important that you think about who it is that you're wanting to actually positively impact through the regulation.
Okay, so my next question, Brent, in doing this work to address forced labour in a meaningful way, what do you think your key priorities should be as a company?
Well, one of the things we have to do is to get to the source of the problem, which means we need to be able to identify and create and support ethical recruitment. That's a key issue, I believe, so that when we are bringing people from whatever industry into our companies or coming into the supply chain, people are being employed ethically. And there are still a number of countries in the world where government sends mixed messages around enabling certain fees to be charged against workers. You have very informal systems operating in key parts of the world, which are large labor sourcing countries. For me, that's a key priority. How do we help people do the right thing at the beginning? If you can get someone recruited without fees being paid by that employee, you address one of the major challenges you have in forced labor, which is about debt bondage. We're looking at work to see about how we can ensure our commitment around making sure that terms and conditions of employment are correct, that we can look to technology to help us create certainty around people's contracts so they're not substituted when they arrive in a receiving country. So for me, those are the key areas. How do we make sure people are properly recruited? And that means companies standing up and being very clear that they will carry the costs of recruitment. At the moment, unfortunately, there is a model that exists in the world that enables companies to take advantage of the fact that other people are paying the costs of them getting their workers. And that's not a viable or sustainable or ethical process going forward.
So you mentioned there, Brent, one or two barriers to driving progress and change in this field. Are there any other things that stand in our way?
Whether it's a barrier or not, it's a moot point, but I believe the fact that we don't hold on to consistency is a barrier. If we dabble in this and then move on to something else, then move on to something else, we're not going to move it along. The barriers are communication. The barriers are getting to the ground to talk to the right people in the language that they understand. The barriers are getting governments to understand that their own actions in some jurisdictions are not helping efforts to combat forced labor, either domestically or within the supply chain or the labor coming out of those countries. So again, it's about building those coalitions that we can use then to work with national actors in particular to help governments understand what their role should properly be, and then to get more people involved. I mean, my hope is that more and more companies, as I said earlier, will look to our coalition as a useful use of their time, and that companies within the CGF family also come in and to support this, because it's going to take everybody. It's not just going to be working in silos or in particular areas of privilege for people who are alleviated of the scourge. It's got to apply to everybody. So getting that business commitment, building that coalition is going to be so important.
So my final question, Brent, and this is one that I do like to finish on, and I ask everybody who comes on the podcast, so humor me here. What keeps you inspired and motivated to jump out of bed in the morning and keep doing the job that you're doing?
We're dealing with people. That's the reality, and that's the fascination of the role in a way, that you hope that every day in some way or another, you are helping someone have a better life than they did the day before. Sometimes it's not that immediate. It takes time to show itself. Sometimes it's not even possible to see the changes that may be occurring. But we need, in the human rights area and in the work that we're doing in CGF through the Forced Labour Coalition, is to make a difference to people's lives. And that's something I think a lot of companies themselves want to do, as their underlying values show, and it's certainly the case with the Coca-Cola company. So helping the Coca-Cola company make a difference, which is part of our purpose in the communities and the workers that are working for us, and either directly or indirectly, is a key part of my motivation.
Lovely. Yes. I think that finding meaning in our day-to-day is possibly the most important thing that we as humans can do. And it's certainly important to hold on to that in these testing global times. So thank you so much for your time today. It was really interesting to learn more about Coca-Cola Company's work on the topic and your involvement with the CGF. We've got a lot to look forward to with the launch of the Coalition of Action.
And it's also thank you to you, Louise, because being part of the Coalition, there's some great corporate partners we're working with. I mean, yes, we've been taking a leading role, but there are other great companies there with us through this fight. And I really appreciate the fact that they are also standing up and supporting what I'm trying to do as well.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you would like to find out more about the CGF and our work on sustainability, you can visit our website at www.theconsumergoodsforum.com. If you like this episode, please do subscribe to the podcast for more episodes coming very shortly. Thank you and see you next time.